welcome to a new episode of Design Cafe, a podcast where we have mindful, candid conversations for designers in tech. This season, we're going to cover a lot of difficult but important topics like the challenges of career growth, toxicity at work, mental health, and diversity, equity, and inclusion. These are topics that maybe don't get talked about as often as we like, but they no less impact us all as designers. I'm your co-host, Susan.
And I'm your co-host, Sandrine.
If you like our podcast, please follow and rate us on your podcast platform. You can follow us on Twitter, where we are at Design Cafe, and LinkedIn, where we are Design Cafe. Our website is designcafe.com, which includes a link to our Buy Me a Coffee page as well, in case you want to buy us a coffee to help support our podcast. This week, episode 71, we are going to talk about money. And I was thinking back on, I think it was probably our end of season 3 reflections. We were discussing, in season 4, maybe we should tackle these difficult topics. And I remember distinctly that the one topic I didn't want to talk about was money.
Yes, it was.
For some reason. And I just felt so uncomfortable about it. And then I was thinking back and I was just like, why did I say that? Because I think we should talk more about money. And it's so important. And I wonder if it's less that I don't want to talk about money and more around how I think so many aspects of this whole money, salaries as designers, salaries in tech, all this stuff is a bit, for me, the system is quite broken. We can deep dive into this, but it's quite broken. And because it's so broken, it makes me uncomfortable. But that makes it even more important to talk about it. So anyway, I'm backtracking on what I said. I think it's really important to talk about money. So Sandrine, why should we talk more about money as designers?
Great question. I mean, as you said, it's a very important topic. I mean, whether you're money driven or not in life, we can't really avoid the fact that money is a mean to survive and get by in our society. So it's very important. I think it's important that we talk about it, because the more we talk about it, the more transparency there is about it, and the more people are comfortable opening up the topic and negotiating as well. I think because the topic of money is such a taboo topic, if you don't feel particularly confident, or if you are a type of person who just generally isn't highly confident, you might really just really struggle having those conversations when you're changing jobs or when you're in a role where you're not paid the market rates. So it's super important that in order to be paid your worth, we make it more of a normal thing to do. So I think that's why it's very important and why we should talk more about it.
I also get this feeling that it's taboo, but I think it's very culturally dependent. I think for me, it feels more taboo here. So we're both in the UK, and I've spent my whole career more or less in the UK. There are lots of reasons or aspects around money and talking about money and salary negotiations that I feel gives this taboo lens on it. But just for context, in other cultures, like for example Norway, where I'm from, it's far less taboo to talk about money, and salary transparency is a huge open thing. And it kind of speaks to a lot of cultural values of sort of openness and transparency and egalitarianism and that sort of thing as well. But just for context, from so people understand what cultural context I come from, in Norway, it's very common, or it's very, the norm is to have clear salary ranges for jobs. Even if you don't have salary ranges on the job ad, it very often, especially in tech, it can link to like a salary calculator on the company's website, where you, for example, can say how many years of experience you have and kind of what kind of academic or training background you have, that sort of thing, all the factors that go into a salary, and then it outputs your salary. And that means you can easily see or understand or work your way into what other people in a company earn as well. You can see like, oh, they have 10 years of experience and they have this degree, so they're probably earning this much. On top of that, like in Norway, you can also actually look up what every single person in Norway has an income and what they pay in tax from a public database. So the whole money thing is the complete opposite in my kind of origin country. And I 100% do not have any discomfort talking about money in that context because it's so open and transparent. And I just feel like being in this, being in the tech industry and the design industry in the UK where we don't have this cultural transparency, it's I suppose it's that dissonance for me that makes me so uncomfortable around it.
Yeah, that makes sense, because I guess because there's no transparency, then you don't know, and then that makes you uncomfortable because it's like a black box, right? Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I'm from France and I feel like France is way worse than the UK, although I don't really have enough experience working in France to maybe tell for sure. But I have a feeling that it's, if anything, it's even more taboo to talk about money there. At least that's how I felt about it. But yeah, all of my experiences in the UK in terms of working life and all this. So I'll be mostly talking from a UK perspective. On the point of transparency, I was wondering, Susan, how transparent do you think we should be? Like, I think there's being transparent, obviously, within your company and with your colleagues and your peers. And then there's also being transparent about your salary when you're looking for a job. So maybe we can treat this as two different questions, because there's like how transparent you should be when you're working and you currently have a role, you're paid a certain amount. How transparent should we be with our colleagues or peers versus how much should you tell about your current salary when you're talking to recruiters, basically when looking for new opportunities?
It goes back to how I think the system is fundamentally broken in our industry, in where we happen to be right now. I very strongly think that, for example, every job description should have a salary range. And I think very, very few / zero job seekers would disagree with me. It's one of the main criteria when you're looking for a job, right? Like, is it meeting my salary expectations? So I think every job description should have a salary range. With that salary range, I think internally there should also be salary, like explicit clear salary bands for each role and each level. Some companies do this really well, and they're very open about it and very transparent about it. In my experience, the majority of companies don't do this, or many, many companies don't do this. And so you're going in into a potential job opportunity without knowing, you know, what is the range for my role, or is there even a range? So yeah, I think having that range explicit and kind of quite set is very important. I also think it's important to actually internally in a company have clear processes for regularly reviewing and updating that range, so it stays market competitive, and to be transparent about that process as well, so people understand. And not every company can be super, super competitive for various reasons. Like, you might not be a super well-funded tech startup, you might be more in the, for example, the cultural sector or medical sector or whatever, and not be able to afford to pay as well as, for example, a Google or an Apple or, you know, etc. But then it's also, again, a matter of being transparent about why and the reason, so people understand what they're going to. And so yeah, when it comes to the second part about like how transparent should you be when you're meeting recruiters, and very often, more or less always, recruiters will ask you, like, oh, what's your salary expectation? Or even, like, what's your current salary?
Yeah, they're two very different questions, though.
Yeah, they're two very different questions. This is a whole other rant, but I hate it when recruiters ask you, what's your current salary? And I basically don't share it, because it should be irrelevant. Like, how is my current salary affecting, you know, what value I can bring into this new role that I'm considering? Things are also very different now that I'm working for myself and set my own rate. It's actually way easier for me to talk money than now that I work for myself, because it's sidetracking. But if the recruiter is asking for your salary expectations, it's, again, there's so many nuances to this, so much complexity. But I think I'm overgeneralizing, but I think a mistake maybe some people make is that they do give salary expectations a bit too readily. And as a designer looking for a job, I would advise that you counter that question with asking for what the range for that job is, if it's not already on the job description, because there's so many issues with the fact that you're as a pool of new candidates, you're being asked about your salary expectations, and there's so much research around how, for example, women of color, people of color say a lower number than certain other more privileged groups. And this also, like, you know, leads to pay disparity and, like, so many problems. Yeah, I don't know. I could go on and on, but I think asking people what their salary expectations are without giving a range for the role is quite problematic. Yeah, I'm obviously very opinionated about this. Well, what are your thoughts on this?
I feel very much the same to you. The question that comes from recruiters about what your current salary is also very much irritates me. I think it annoys me, because I think it furthers discrimination. I think you might be underpaid in your current role for whatever reason. Like, maybe your salary is not actually meeting market rates and being competitive. And what annoys me is that sometimes it's being noted on the side as a way to give you a lower ball offer whenever you eventually get the job offer later on, and being like, let's say, I don't know, they might offer you something that is 10K more than your current salary, but actually in reality, market rate wise, you deserve 20K increase, let's say. And that's really not fair, because then if further discrimination, you might still be paid lower than, I don't know, a male counterpart, for example, because you may actually have been not great at negotiating salaries in previous companies. And, all of these factors pile up. And I think sometimes when you finally have a chance to rectify your salary to meet market rates, sometimes this kind of kills your chance if you don't know how to effectively handle that situation. So for me, I'm very much the same as you, where I try not to answer the question. When I've been asked sometimes why I don't want to share it, as I actually say, sometimes I'm just being honest and I'm like, I actually don't think this is relevant and my current salary doesn't meet the market rates. Sometimes I give a figure if they really insist that actually encompasses my entire package of benefits as well. And that can sometimes get closer to the new salary expectation I have. And that's a bit cheeky, but I've heard quite a few people doing this in my design peers as well. So yeah, I mean, if you can really avoid answering the question, it's better. And yeah, I think at some point you are also in your own right to say that you don't want to share that information, because that's just private to you and your company. And it's not relevant as long as you're not asking for a new rate or a new salary that is way above the current market rate. So yeah. In terms of how transparent we should be in company, I very much agree with you. We should have salary brackets that should be embraced in companies as a normal thing. Maybe some companies are wary of doing this because, as you said, they don't have salary brackets that are very competitive, but nonetheless, you know, more transparency is always better. You can always compensate with amazing projects, share options, or, you know, better benefits like pension, you know, holidays and that sort of thing. All of these count sometimes for someone to counterbalance. Not everyone is interested in just money. Like, obviously, having a salary that meets, you know, your living expenses and all this is super important. But there's some people that will consider more than just this. Like, I've worked in the charity sector and people by default will accept lower salaries because they get to work in that sector that pays less in general. And it's not always the central part for everyone when they're looking for a role. So yeah, so just really embracing that transparency, I think it's really important. And I wish that sometimes as well, it was just more accepted to talk money between colleagues and share salaries. And actually, if you have salary brackets, you wouldn't even need to share your salary because, as you said, people would kind of be aware already of roughly where on that bracket you would be. And then let's say you move along that bracket a little bit based on experience and performance, but it would be within a range. And yeah, so yeah, I'm very much alongside you on that one.
Yeah, I think I'm not surprised because I think the thing is, talking more about salaries and money and benefits, it having these open discussions, it benefits us more, us as in us who are being paid. It just benefits us to know, if, you know, hypothetically, if you're working in the same company, it would benefit you to know how much I earn and me to earn, know how much you earn. Who it doesn't benefit is a company, because they feel like quite often a company discourages employees from talking about salaries amongst each other. I've actually observed and heard a few times, like, don't share your salaries amongst each other. And then there's some sort of excuse around, like, oh, not everyone is comfortable talking about salaries, or that's why we don't share.
You know, I've observed that from companies that actually have zero transparency and zero salary brackets whatsoever. And often they don't want people to talk about it because they have huge discrimination between.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So it's they don't want us to talk about it because then we're going to realize that, oh, that person who has the same amount of experience as me and the same similar background and we're equal, like, you know, that person earns 10K more than me or 10K less than me. And they don't want to unearth that. And why do some people earn more than others? And again, this comes back to how I feel like the system is broken. I feel like there's so much complexity in the whole job offer negotiation stage where certain candidates are given a higher salary just because, you know, they really want that to get that offer out and get that candidate to accept the offer. Maybe the team is really, really needing a designer right now and they just really need that candidate, you know, then they really need to fill that role, or, you know, whatever reason. But this is where the issues come in as well, where there are differences in salary for pretty much the same role, the equivalent job. So yeah, I'm contrasting these problematic experiences with good experiences I've had, where we not only had clear ranges and brackets, but also had very clear criteria for how you moved up either within the range or moved from one range to the next range, typically by getting promotion. And I'm not saying this is perfect, but in those good experiences, we would strive to have objective criteria for how you moved up in levels or ranges or within a range. And they would be objective in the sense that they would be very, like, quantifiable. For example, years of experience, or does this person have a master's degree, or does this person have a bachelor's degree? Now, I just need to point out, I think there are issues with paying people more if they have a master's degree or a bachelor's degree, but there was an attempt to kind of quantify the criteria, so it's very clear. And so you knew that, oh, if I work in this company for 1 or 2 years longer, I'll get paid more. Like, that's how I get paid more. And again, it's not a perfect process, but I think it's contrasting that with what I've most often observed is that someone decides based on their subjective judgment whether whether someone is qualified or, you know, what's called, yeah, should be paid more or not, based on, like, these detailed performance reviews and performance feedback rounds and decisions and making a case and pitching to HR. And there's so much human bias and room for human error and just subjective opinions in this kind of muddy process of kind of evaluating whether or not you as a designer should get paid more, that I'm definitely biased towards having a more rigid or quantifiable isn't necessarily the right word, but having an approach where you're like, okay, years of experience, that's how we decide.
Yeah, I would agree, but then in my experience, years of experience does not equal quality of work. I have seen some juniors doing better work sometimes than some people with so-called 15 years of experience. They don't always apply for the same companies and all this. The industry that you're in also will make a big difference in terms of what kind of salary expectations you can have. I don't know. As you said, it's hard. There's no perfect process. How do you really effectively assess someone? I think the best way is to assign a salary bracket to a role and really assess how much value is that role, just the role, not the person, the role, having a person doing that role, how much value would it create for the business? And just assign a value, a salary bracket to that, obviously in line with market trends and all this. And then after that, you can go on and find that person. And, you know, that person may have 6 years of experience. That person may have 10. If you think that they are good for that job, then obviously you can vet them appropriately. But I think it's, yeah, I don't know. Obviously, each individual had different salary expectations and so forth based on levels and titles. It's really hard to quantify it. Really, I don't know if there's a better a best way of doing it, but I think at least assigning salary brackets based on your industry and the role that, like, the level of like whether it's a senior principal, head of, and all of this usually already helps tremendously. And there's tons of salary surveys being done. You can hire people to do that kind of surveys for you as well and support you in making those decisions. I've seen a company I've worked at doing this, and they came back with, honestly, I found pretty decent brackets. So yeah, I mean, it is feasible, but I think it's kind of easier to do it that way. And then that way the recruiter can also communicate back when, let's say, you have someone that comes in and say, well, here's my salary expectation, then the recruiter can actually say, well, for this role, here's our brackets, and we won't be able to go above that. And then you can actually have a much better conversation as a candidate with the recruiter, because if you're not willing to lower your salary expectations, then maybe it's not the right role for you. But at least you didn't waste each other's time. Honestly, like, companies that carry you on in the process when they know they can't meet your salary expectations, like, it annoys me so much. And it's not good for the candidate. It's not good for the company to waste each other's time like this. So, yeah, I think salary brackets can really solve all of this.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I agree. And I think we're talking about the same similar approaches, but slightly differently as well. I also think it should be, you know, relative to your industry and market rate. Like, I don't, and as much as I'd love us all to earn really, really well, it's different roles and different disciplines and industries do get paid differently. I don't think it's like, it's not possible to be, or it is possible, but I don't think it's right that you're completely quantifiable about it, but also not completely qualifiable. But what I'm trying to say is that, you know, there's, on the one hand, it's this extreme example of like only years of experience count, which I don't agree with, because there are issues with that, and I agree with what you said, but on the other end, it's like, oh, it's just up to the manager, or, you know, the pitch that the manager makes to the HR. So there's a middle ground there. And yeah, coming back to this whole transparency thing, I think because there's no right way of doing this, I think it's even more important for companies to then decide internally what works for them. Like, this is our process, and these are our criteria, and this is how we pay people, and then be open about that to candidates, so that candidates can then not just evaluate the salary itself, but also how they how the company approaches salary. So for example, if me as a candidate, I'm facing a company where they have a more wishy-washy, a more kind of qualitative evaluation approach to salaries, that doesn't quite align with how I feel I should be paid, then probably the company doesn't align with me and I probably won't apply for that job. Whereas if it's a company that has clear brackets, leans more towards the stricter numeric criteria with some, you know, qualitative assessment side of things, then maybe that's more of a company for me. Just, you're not just choosing as a job applicant, you're not just choosing a salary or like a clear like number, I want this X amount of money. You're also applying for the company values and how they communicate and how they decide things and yeah, all of this stuff. And that gets baked into how they approach salaries as well.
I agree, for sure. For me, it's what annoys me is that when there's no benchmark to refer yourself to, as to, like, sometimes I give a salary expectation to recruiter, and if you get no feedback as to whether that's within their brackets, I guess, sometimes you just keep going with the process in the dark and then you're hoping, crossing your fingers, that the offer will be good at the end. And it's like, why is this? This is such a silly way of doing things. It's like, tell me up front what you're willing to pay a candidate. Give me a bracket, because it's fine if you can't give me an exact number. But then we can open the conversation. And if it's a bit lower than expected, what else do you offer to compensate maybe? And maybe the project is still worth it. You know, sometimes it can be in an industry that you've been wanting to work for a while. I don't know. Sometimes there's things to compensate. So yeah. One thing I wanted to mention is that it's a different, slightly different topic, but why don't companies reward loyalty? Like, I feel like sometimes companies would rather lose someone over increasing their rate or their salary to meet market rates, as opposed to, yeah, just giving them that raise that they deserve. It's like, I find it insane. Or like, I mean, I've known some people, actually these people in France, and that tells you why it's so taboo in my head to spend my money in France, who have not been seen a salary increase in the whole time they've been working for a company, which was sometimes 5 years. It's crazy. Like, salary rates, inflation, all of this has changed since you've been employed. Like, your value is not the same over time. And like, how can a company expect to keep you and maintain, like, retain you as an employee if they don't, I don't know, if they don't reward you or at least keep you on the same worth over time, if that makes sense? I just find it crazy.
Yeah, I guess I should clarify that that's also sort of what I meant with what I do like about having something like, I don't know, years of experience. Because I don't think it should be like people with 5 years of experience should be paid. Anyway, you know what I mean. But one of the benefits of that is that, you know, if you have two people, not even two people, but if you've been within the company for 5 years and then you roll over into the sixth year and seventh year and eighth year, and the company has clear, like, oh, you get paid more the longer you're here, that's, you know, that's a good thing. So yeah, I completely agree. And I know people who've been, you know, in companies for years and years and just not gotten a pay rise, not even inflation. And it's, yeah, like, yeah, mind-boggling. I just don't comprehend.
Yeah, exactly. And then eventually that person will ask for a raise or not even ask and just leave. If they ask for a raise, let's say they at least bother to ask, and the company says no, what they're going to do is that they're going to just leave, and then that company has to hire at the raise, at the rate that person asked for anyway, because a candidate would never ask or accept a salary that was as low as that person. The cost of recruiting and then the cost of new salary anyway, they may as well have had updated that person's salary in the first place. And I find like it's crazy that some companies go and take the risk of losing candidates that have built knowledge of their industry, their products, their markets. Like, that also holds its share of value. Like, someone who is fresh to a company, yes, they bring a different perspective and they bring new skills that, you know, are obviously incredibly valuable. But someone who's been there 2 years has a knowledge of the system, has a knowledge of things work, has a knowledge of the market, has tested things, know what works or hasn't worked in the past. And they just have a very different type of knowledge than someone who's new. And you need both. Like, you need both in a company. I think new recruits bring new, fresh momentum, new perspective, which is incredibly important. And then you have the more longer employees that obviously bring that, you know, that layer of knowledge. I mean, sometimes I've seen some engineers in my companies, like, that I've worked at, where, you know, engineer says like, yeah, that's the only person left who knows that system. If that person leaves, don't know. Yeah. If that person leaves, we have no idea how to fix this thing. I just think it's crazy. Then it's like absolute mission critical for that company to keep that employee. And it's obviously not sustainable over time, but like, it's pretty telling as to how much knowledge an employee can hold about your systems and how things work. And that should also hold value for a company, and you should be rewarding that loyalty of staying over time. And yeah, I mean, I just don't feel like it's something that is really embraced by a lot of companies. I've seen it in some companies, but not all of them.
Yeah. And one of the really common patterns in our industry, in the design industry, and probably, you know, wider other industries as well, is I've observed this so many times and also experienced it myself, that the only way to get the raise that you should get, because you suddenly have, you know, more years of experience and more domain knowledge, and not just domain knowledge, but like, just you've developed your skills, because that's what you do. If you do a good job over time, you get better at it. And the only way to get paid fairly or to get a raise is to switch jobs. And the painful thing is that instead of the company, the old company, giving you that raise, they'd rather let you go and then spend all this money recruiting a new person, like,
yeah,
you said.
Exactly.
And on top of this, what I often see is that the new person that comes in to replace the person who left because they got a raise by switching jobs, they pay the new person what the old person got at the new place
was asking for.
Exactly. Yeah. So yeah, it's like, exactly. So you had, that happens all the time. So it's like, you had
complete
the money,
waste of money,
total waste of money. You had the money all along. Like, what?
I swear there's a gamble aspect to it, of being like, let's see how far we can push the employee until they quit. It's
100%.
Like, they're taking the gamble. It's like, it's just, I find it infuriating. Like, it's like, just pay what your employees deserve. And if it's a problem of performance with that employee, then have proper performance reviews in place and justify why there is no salary increase. And then you can have a much more meaningful conversation with your manager. It's I don't know, it's not that hard. It's just processes to put in place. I was wondering, Susan, if you have, I don't know, advice or best practices or things that you do nowadays to negotiate salaries. I know that now you're in the contract world, but when you were in your old days of being a perm, how did you used to negotiate salaries?
I find that really difficult to answer, because I feel like I'm in such a position of privilege where I can be quite firm on these things. So I feel like whatever I say that has worked for me, it won't apply to everyone, unfortunately. And therefore, I don't think this is advice. I think what I'm about to say isn't advice. It's not, you should do this. It's more of a, this is what I had to do to, like, not survive, not that dramatic, but like, this is what I just had to do because it's just, the system doesn't work. But yeah, again, caveating that, you know, I'm privileged, very, very privileged enough to do this. But so when it comes to negotiating salaries or discussing salaries, when I'm considering a new job opportunity at a new company, what I've done and what's worked is just, well, one, not share my current salary. To try and get
first step.
to try my best to get the range for the role. And three, I've just said either a range. Well, a range doesn't quite work when you say a range, because like then they will default to the lower end of your range always. So I've actually, yeah, sorry, I'm backtracking. I've said a number, and that number's been quite high, because I think, you know, if you say like a range from like, I don't know, 1 to 4, obviously making up numbers, then the company is obviously going to default to the lower end, so the one, right? So like say 4 is what I would have done in this analogy. The other thing is, going back to your point about it's not just about the salary, like there are other reasons you join a company. So if the company is being a bit fussy about that one quite high on the higher end number that I give, then I try to negotiate other benefits. So for example, if they offer stock options, then I negotiate more stock options, or I negotiate more flexibility in how I work, or whatever is important to me, basically, I try to negotiate. But yes, it's not, especially in this climate, not everyone can do that. And it also depends on where you are in your career. I think I could do that when I was a perm, because I was, again, like lucky and privileged enough to be able to afford to lose out on opportunities that I really, really wanted, and be willing to walk away from an opportunity if they didn't meet my salary expectations. And so, yeah, I mean, of course, that's really hard right now. Just as a side note, as a contractor, and maybe this is relevant to freelancers who are listening as well, because I mean, it's a different marketplace, but as a freelancer, I have a day rate. That is it. I'm not budging. That's like take it or leave it. If I'm budging, then it's up to me to decide if, for example, oh, this is a great project, or this is an amazing client, or I'll negotiate things like I'll go a little bit lower if I can work a certain way, or you know, that sort of thing. But it's up to me, and it's not up to the client.
Yeah, just to bounce on what you've said, I agree. I have a fairly similar approach. I do agree with the fact that we are privileged. I think as product designers on the market, even obviously a little bit less lately, although the market has started to pick up again from what I can see. In general, it's always been in our favor, especially if you have several years of experience and you've started becoming a mid-level. I think for junior designers, it's a lot harder out there. I think what matters as well is to do research. For me, I always do tons of research. I look at salary surveys in different industries. I look at Glassdoor, LinkedIn surveys, like salary tools where, you know, they just give you an estimate of what people earn. I look at that if there's like at company level on Glassdoor, there's actually sometimes quite a lot of information for some companies, especially the bigger ones. So you can get an idea actually of like what kind of people are paid for a particular job title. And that's hugely helpful, because then you can actually place yourself based on your level of experience, what kind of industry you're entering. And you actually have numbers that are, like the numbers are there, like especially surveys that are quite robust and led through different companies and loads of employees, like they are very like robust quantitative, you know, reports. So it's something that you can use, and then you actually have something to rely on if a recruiter is questioning your salary expectation. And you can say, well, based on, you know, the salary market, the market rates, you can even, you know, talk about what resource you've been using to estimate this. You can say, this is just what I should be expecting to be paid for my experience. And, you know, leave it obviously up to them, I guess. I think it's true that there's always the question of like how much of a position of power you're in. I think in a position where you have the advantage over the companies, in the sense that there's not enough candidates in general, which, you know, mostly that's where the market has been up to last year, I would say. As I said, you can really like discard some offers when they don't, or like some jobs when they just don't meet your salary expectations, and you can just stay strong on it. I think what's interesting to do as well is to make yourself look like a candidate that is busy. I think for me, I really create a sense, I create a sense of urgency with recruiters, and actually often so nice is very legit sense of urgency. I have several companies who I'm in the pipeline with, and I let them know you're not the only one I'm considering. I can let them know which ones I'm, you know, in favor of sometimes, like, but I make it clear that they're not the only job that I'm considering. And up, like, right away, they know that they're in competition, and you kind of switch the tension in a way where the tension is more for them to meet my expectation, especially if they need to hire right now and they need to hire someone who has, you know, the expertise that I have. So it's kind of flipping a little bit on its head in a way, and that's really helpful. And then obviously when it comes to offer stage, if you have several offers, weirdly for me, it's always happened with wonderful timing that I get all of my offers at the same time. And then very much so you can say, well, I have this other offer with this company, and then you kind of let them. That's how you use that for negotiating quite a bit. And that's hugely helpful.
Yeah, those are good tips. I can't help but think, and I'm doing that whole like, oh, let me play the devil's advocate thing here, which I actually really hate it when people do it. So I'm just like, why am I doing this? Let me play devil's advocate. I think it's because, okay, I've been on hiring teams where we've been like interviewing candidates, and the candidates have told us like, oh, you know, I'm considering other options and offers and that sort of thing. And not me personally, because I'm amazing. No, but I've observed that the hiring manager who I report to then goes, oh, is this candidate just like considering jobs for the money? Like they're just going for whichever job is paying more, you know. So I guess my whole devil's advocate thing here is, does the whole showing that you're busy and that you're considering other offers, is there a way it could backfire so it seems like you're just going for whatever job pays more?
Yeah, I mean, it's a legit question. I think it maybe is the way you frame it. For me, I'm kind of, it's not that I'm making it sound like it's whoever gives me the highest offer wins, you know. It's, I'm just saying that I'm considering several roles. They're all interesting to me. And usually recruiters would see that there's a trend in the roles that I'm applying to. They will be either in a similar industry or tackling quite similar type of problem space or something like that. And, you know, I'm just going to say that I want to meet the teams. I want to see what it will feel like to work in each of those places. So first for me, it's like I need to vet each of these companies to see which is the right fit for me. And then when it comes to offer stage, then yes, like in all honesty, it's also about who can meet my expectations. I will also throw in the mix, obviously, who made me feel, I don't know, like I wanted to work with them the most, who has the most interesting project, mission, and all of that. So it will be really a mix. If there's a role that I'm really keen on, I will let the recruiter know you are top of my list. And I've let some companies know, like, you know, you are my, like, you know, this is the role that I'm most interested in, but I have also these other stages in. Sometimes I also just tell them that I have other stages in so that they speed up the recruitment process as well, because sometimes it can just drag on and it's just easier for everyone if it all happens in a rapid manner, let's say, as well. I think there's putting pressure, and then really putting pressure in a manner where it's just a little bit too much. I think there's a softness about it. There's an approach where you can be a bit more, yeah, soft, I would say. But also, like, you know, I think it's quite interesting that someone would say, oh, are they taking whatever offers them the most money? It's like, at the end of the day, we live in a world where, yes, that matters. It's, in honesty, yes, it matters. And if you know you're not going to be able to be competitive on money, then have your game on to tell that kind of why they should still join you. And it's a different conversation that your recruiter can have with them.
Yeah, I've always been, you know, like you need to be paid what you're worth and what you're valued, and don't let companies lowball you, and don't let them undervalue your worth. And that's, I mean, that can be really, it can be psychologically difficult if you really, really, really want a job, or you really liked a team, or often companies are also doing this thing where they say, oh, we can't put you on this number from the get-go. We'll put you on the lower number, but in 6 months you'll be put on this higher number. And, you know, they'll make these promises, which
I find
often,
these never happen, by the way.
These never happen. Exactly. So they'll try and, like, you know,
unless they're in your contracts and you need to make sure it's in writing.
Exactly. So it's I don't know, it can be psychologically difficult to stay firm in those situations, which goes back to also what I said about how I've been privileged enough to be able to walk away. Like, I've stayed firm and then been willing to walk away. But what I was thinking about as well, is this me doing the whole devil's advocate thing again? Probably. This is not because I think your advice about being staying competitive and stuff is an issue. It's more around, like, how the system is broken. What happens, or how do you feel if you get that number that you're asking for, and you go into the company and there's someone else does the same job as you and has a similar, like, experience and background, and they're not paid the same as you because they didn't negotiate in the same way as you, or they've been in the company for 3 years and they haven't been willing to give that person a raise, and so you're coming in at the same equivalent level, equivalent experience, but you're being paid so much more? So I guess it's like to what we were discussing earlier, when you leave a company because you don't get a raise and then they hire someone who get paid what you asked for. Like, what if you're that person?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, I can only be responsible for myself, right? It's really sad. Look, I don't feel good about it. And I've had a colleague in the past putting up an argument after being offered, that person was contracted, was offered a perm on our team, and his perm offer was higher than mine, and he knew what my salary was as perm. And he actually contested and say, why is my offer higher than this person who's on the team? It wasn't higher by much, but still it was enough to be significant. So I really appreciated, you know, the transparency and the lengths that person went to, you know, to just basically rectify, or at least just stand up for us, I guess, you know, as employees. I think when you're a new joiner, it's kind of hard because you don't really know what the company is about. You only know what they communicate to the external world. You know, they can give you salary brackets, but it doesn't mean that everyone has been moved into salary brackets. It's really hard. Like, you're working with quite small knowledge. And yeah, I mean, obviously at some point you do what's best for yourself. Like, as a candidate, you know, you've done some work to know what your worth is on the market, and you work towards it. It is, I feel like it's hard to, like, you can't be responsible for what another employee is being paid in that company that you're joining. For me, that's the responsibility of the company. I think as a candidate, if you can see that that's a practice and you feel like this really strongly goes against your value, then maybe consider joining another one, because you can say, I don't like your salary practices, or I don't like the look of how you're treating your employees. And is this going to be me in 5 years? You know, like, you can have that reflection and incorporate it in how you're going to choose the company, I guess. But it's hard. Like, I don't think you can put the responsibility on the candidate or the new employee on this. It would be easier, but it's I don't think it's fair, because as a candidate and a new employee, you don't have the ability to change the system that's in place in the company. So yeah, you can decide to reject the role if that really goes against ethically your ethics and all of this. But yeah. But I agree. I mean, it's a fine line. I mean, it's hard, but, like, I mean, I have taken some offers where it was, you know, in reflection when I was looking at the whole package, it was the lower offer of the two or three roles that I was being offered. But it's just because it was fitting me better. I prefer the team. Like, it has a huge aspect into the factor. Like, for me, what I tend to do is that I just let each company know. I tend to let each company know basically what I've been offered, so that at least they're knowing what kind of playing field they are in, you know. And I actually had a recruiter once thanking me for me being transparent about the offers I got on the market, because they were so much lower than every single other company I was working with and candidating with, And the recruiter actually, like, he thanked me and said, thanks for letting us know. It's actually really helpful, because now we can, well, clearly we're not competitive on the market. And now we can actually have a conversation of, you know, are we just not going to attract good talent because we are not offering the rates that are other tech other tech companies offer. And that's also really helpful. So yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. And I think it goes back to what I said about how, you know, what we're advising isn't necessarily the best practice, but it's what we need to do given the way how we find ourselves in a system that is broken. And it's broken because it should be on the companies to fix the broken system. It's not our responsibility, as you say. And so this is just basically what we need to do in order to preserve our value.
And I actually am starting to also guilt myself a lot less, although sometimes I have my guilty days where I'm like, my imposter syndrome comes up and like, I'm paying way too much for what I'm doing and for the level of my skills. But I also know that if I ask for a salary, my male counterpart is probably asking for 10% more.
Yeah.
I also know of some people that negotiate bonus on entry. It's like joining bonuses. Like,
yes, yeah.
I know some people do all these things. I don't do that personally. I don't have the guts to do it. But I know some people are ruthless on the market and they ask for way more. And, you know, like sometimes I'm just thinking, well, actually, I seem to be pretty like lowballing myself most of the time. So, yeah.
But I mean, this is it. And I think it also speaks to the nerves I have when we talk about this, like it's infuriating because this is Susan getting really worked up on the podcast, because obviously, like, this is a very complex thing to talk about. Like, we keep, you know, it's a what about this and what about that and dependencies, and like, because the system is already broken, not assuming the systemic inequalities of gender as well, and of things like imposter syndrome and women tending to undervalue themselves and stuff. So that comes on top of all the complexities we already talked about. So it's like, I don't know, you can't win. You just can't win. So
it's like, whatever you do, you can't get it right.
Yeah. So to summarize, we're just trying to do what's best for us in a fundamentally broken system, and it needs to be fixed, is my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to touch on as well on like what's the best practices, or at least things that we've learned in negotiating a raise, or like, let's say you want to ask for promotion, you also want a raise, or you just want a raise on its own. I have a few ideas, or like a few things that I personally do, but I was kind of curious to know if you have any particular approach, Susan.
This is probably going to be quite disappointing for conversation's sake, but I think if you need to ask for a raise and if you need to ask for promotion, then the company is not doing their job. That's my answer.
Amen.
So yeah, of course, I'm talking about utopia here, or, you know, what I subjectively think is a utopia. I don't know. I'm going to do the easy thing and bounce back to you. What do you think?
I found it interesting that you say that if a company doesn't promote you like of their own will, I guess, or raise you of their own will, then it's not a good company. I found that in the UK, at this personal my experience, it looks like it's very rare that you get promoted if you don't ask for it. The only person and company where that happened to me, I had a incredible manager. She came on the podcast, she's called Leah, and massive shout out if you get to work with her, do, because honestly, like, a good manager who advocates for you, recognize your potential, and just literally does pitch for you is quite rare in my experience. They exist, but they don't come across very often. And since, to be honest, I've had good managers, but none have taken the initiative to promote me, I would say. But maybe also sometimes it's not necessarily that the manager didn't want to. Maybe it's also that the company didn't facilitate those kind of practice as well. So I think it's unfortunately not really a thing in the UK as much as it should be. I think if you come from a perspective of pitching for yourself, which you should always be prepared to do anyway, I think what's difficult is first to assess what's the process in your company. Like, is there a regular performance review system in place? Is there a time of the year where you can ask for these kind of things? Like, some companies ask to have promotion cases come every 6 months or on a year basis, and the raise and promotions often come at the same time. So usually it's kind of good to stick to that schedule if that's planned. You can prepare that ahead with your manager, and it's kind of, I think it's easy if it's embedded in the process of the company. But sometimes if there's none, then it's a lot harder because you have to create a space for the conversation and you have to kind of bring it up yourself, and that's often very uncomfortable. And you have to kind of like have the guts to do it, basically. But let's say you've kind of got to that point where there's a sort of like a performance review happening where you can discuss a promotion case or a raise. Again, it really depends on your company. I've seen a lot of companies these days that have a very passive way of doing it, in the sense that you fill out a long form where you write massive paragraphs of what you've done in the year, and then you kind of leave it up to your manager to do the rest. Personally, I really don't like that. The places where it's worked the best for me is where I actually had a chance to do a mini presentation about myself, and where I really come prepared. I evaluate what's been my impact on the business. And you know, like, you can get those metrics very easily when you work in squads and projects. There's often success metrics that get communicated about each project that you've released. And often these come with impact on the business, whether they were internal, external, etc. And you can bring those figures and you can say, well, you know, you can explain how you were an essential part of that process of leading to that success metric. And often that success metric is linked to a money figure of some kind. You know, you've designed a flow where you've saved the company £20,000. I don't know, like, there's like a lot of things like that where you can link it to a business figure. If you've driven more acquisition, what's the cost of acquisition for your business? And also, like, what is the revenue attached to each new acquisition? How many actually converts? And how many new users have you converted for your business? And that there's a direct money figure attached to that. If you talk in those terms, then right away you start showing your value to the business and you actually tell them why they don't want to miss out on keeping you. And why also you deserve a raise. Like, if you brought in more money in, then you also deserve to bring more money in. And you can use these things to both prove that you've developed your skills, that you've delivered good performance, and that you are an asset to their company. And that's usually super helpful. So kind of preparing those like mini pitch about yourself, it's obviously better if you can deliver in person. And if it has to be on text, then try to write it in a snappy way like that. And it's, for me, it's been actually quite helpful. And I think it's helped my manager build a case for me as well in the past. So
yeah, it's interesting how we have our different experiences of this. And I think it's because if I'm interviewing with a company, then I also, in addition to just, you know, all the salary and negotiations and stuff, I also try and understand how the company approaches these things. I think it's very subjective what you're comfortable doing and what you're happy doing. But what you just described, I hate doing that. I'm going to be honest, I absolutely hate it. Not from the perspective of like, I don't want to do it. Like, it makes me uncomfortable. But I'm not saying you shouldn't do it the way you've done it. But I think for me, it's more around, I don't like working for companies that requires people in the company to do that. And again, there are no right and wrong ways of doing it. It's more around like, what is the match between my values and principles and the company's values and principles? And I think to your point about how you've rarely seen that people get promoted without people asking for it, I, I, I've worked in several companies that promote people not spontaneously, but that takes the initiative, I suppose, to do it. And again, it goes to the fact that I was lucky enough to find companies that had quite different ways of approaching these things, and I could tease that out in the interview process. And it wasn't just about this company promotes people in this way. I could tell in the way the company had designed their interview process as well that they thought that they put a lot of effort into kind of disrupting the traditional way of interviewing people as well. So for example, doing blind CV reviews and that sort of thing, just, you know, to kind of try different ways. And it's...
Yeah, I guess you don't like when it's all about the monetary value of what you bring. It should be about more than that. I get it. And I think it's kind of it's a bit sad that sometimes it gets to that. But I think for me, I guess I'm trying to also be a bit down to earth that at the end of the day, the business is here to make a profit. And if I talk the same language as them, at least I know that they're going to hear my message. And I agree, like, you know, the company should value their staff for other reasons and all this. But like, for example, you know, they should put a price on the knowledge that you hold about their systems and their market and all of this. But unfortunately, I haven't observed that, not through a lot of companies. So until that happens, I guess, yeah. I will remain cynical.
but things aren't either or, right? Like there are great companies that do the approach you just described that are great for a number of reasons. And you might, you know, as a candidate, you weigh up all these pros and cons. You look at the company as a whole. It's not just... I don't want listeners to go away from this episode thinking like, oh, these are the criteria for a company and like they must have brackets. Yeah, it's personal and you need to decide what's important to you. What are you willing to do? Yeah. What are you not willing to do? And obviously, like, we're two different people and it's not that... I don't think it's that we agree on what's the best approach. I think it's we just have different... preferences for things. And so a part of this is also to figure out for yourself what's important to you in this process when it comes to money, when it comes to raises and promotions.
I think what I found helpful with like gathering data over my actual impact and monetary value on business is that it gives you a boost of confidence and legitimacy for asking for a raise. And for me, who has imposter syndrome and is not comfortable asking for money, it's been of huge help actually, because I have a number in front of me of actually the impact that I've had. So then I feel, because sometimes I would feel bad about asking for more money. You know, there's a whole thing about feeling bad about it. But if you can compensate it with a view of actually how much you've brought to the business, then suddenly you're like, oh, okay, actually, it's a two-way thing. And for me, that facilitates that two-way perspective in a way. And that's helped me feel more empowered to ask for getting what I'm worth actually on the market, if that makes sense.
That makes a lot of sense. I think kind of showing your impact with like clear metrics and how you delivered business value, for me, it's easier for some roles than others. But I'm thinking about colleagues who are user researchers or colleagues who are content designers. It's harder to produce those outcomes if you have a role like that.
Yeah, I agree. Also, I did this when I was half a PM, half a designer. So I was as a PM, you're heavy on the metrics. So yes, I totally agree. You can't quantify everything as easily. You can't quantify your impact as easily when you're in more of those, I guess, support type of functions that are obviously very essential, but like they are not seen as the, sometimes they're not embedded in just one squad, for example. So they can't obviously, measure the impact in the same manner. But I do think it's very essential for us sometimes to think about what is our impact though. And I don't think sometimes we do that enough. And sometimes that's also why we don't have a seat at the table, by the way. It's a whole other conversation. But I think whether we like it or not, it's I think it's important that we do have that conversation for ourselves, because until you understand your impact and how to quantify it to some manner, and you can quantify in ways that are, you know, it doesn't have to be just monetary value. It's like, yeah, you won't be able to justify sometimes your value to your team or like to directors, to C-level and all of this. And that actually causes harm over time to your function and your expertise over time. So I think the better we come to do this in the capitalistic system, in the capitalist system, I mean, yeah, again, I think sometimes we have to do things we don't like. I think this is one of those things.
Yes, exactly. It's exactly that you know, we should have more of these conversations about what is value, what is impact. Mm-hmm. I think it's, of course, it is easier to discuss value and impact or think about it when it has a quantify, like is a metric or has a quantifiable value or relates to money. But, you know, to your point, I think we should have more conversations in companies around the value of, I'm just going to take an easy example because I could go on and on about these examples, but like the value of glue people. So glue people are those people in your company mm-hmm. who do a lot of work and deliver so much value in terms of connecting the right people together, getting the right people in the room, facilitating processes, like making sure the right meetings are set up, making sure the right conversations happen, making sure, you know, that's tremendous value as well, because it makes sure that shit gets done. And I'm not describing a project manager. I'm describing, it could be an engineer, can be a glue person, a designer can be a glue person, all of this stuff. And those are harder to quantify, but they're incredibly valuable, because on the whole, if you take a step back and if you manage to think in systems and high level, you'll see that they bring tremendous value as well. So yeah, it's, wow, this is a difficult topic. There's so much to this.
I mean, it is, you know, but like, yeah, I think we need to reflect on that. What is value? And yeah, it's completely other topic, but it's so interesting though. It's if you want to assess your worth as an individual and then also as an expert in a company, how do you quantify this? How do you measure it? I think in the design world, to be honest, we've not figured it out yet. And it's causing us issues where we have design leaders that are really struggling to make a place for themselves and sometimes don't have a seat at the table still today. We need to be better at this. And it's because the other functions, like the more classic functions, they have figured it out and they're dominating the conversation from that perspective. And until we figure out how to level field a little bit there, I think it's going to create issues for us. I think if you also want to ask for a raise, again, just like you would do when you're looking for a new role to assess your worth on the market, I think you can just totally do that as well to see whether you're being paid your worth on the market right now. And all of these data from the market, all these surveys that are being done, again, you can still go to Glassdoor, LinkedIn, and pull out all that data and actually confront your company and say, you pay me less than what I'm worth on this market. I could get this if I was to look for a job tomorrow. You know, this is my worth on the market. So let's do something about it. And again, you know, having those facts at hand sometimes is kind of helpful, because it's not just your... I feel like sometimes it moves the talk from being subjective to a bit more tangible, I guess, because the figures are there.
If you can stick to the more factual bit in all the different variants we've discussed... That I guess that is our advice. Stick to the factual bits. And with that, I think we're going to round off this episode. Yeah, I'm not going to summarize everything we talked about because it was so much, but we talked about money. that's the summary.
Nailed it, Susan.
Lots of complexity. We hope you found this interesting. As always, you can follow us on Twitter at Design Cafe and LinkedIn. We are Design Cafe, and our website is designcafe.com.